Chapter 30. The Key to Earth's Lost Civilization. Since I began work on Fingerprints of the Gods in the early 1990s, I've been an advocate for the unorthodox notion that an advanced civilization flourished during the Ice Age and was destroyed in the cataclysms that brought the Ice Age to an end. I've written my books to make the case and provide supporting evidence for this possibility. I've suggested a number of locations that I feel would be worth looking into, including, most controversially, Antarctica. And I invested nearly 10 years of my life in arduous and sometimes highly risky scuba diving adventures, searching for man-made structures submerged by rising sea levels at the end of the Ice Age. So I've walked the walk, but it's been a bit like tracking the invisible man. There are signs of his presence everywhere. He has touched this. He has reshaped that. This was how he did mathematics. These were his beliefs. But the man himself remains concealed. There's not even the option to guess the appearance and character of the lost civilization by wrapping its face in bandages like the hero of the H.G. Wells novel. It's much more elusive. Physical traces that might point to its homeland have either been so completely demolished or so thoroughly hidden from view that they're extremely difficult to find, especially so by an archaeological community already pre-convinced of their non-existence and therefore unwilling to look for them. What's tantalizing, however, is that the influence of the lost civilization declares itself repeatedly in the commonalities shared by supposedly unconnected cultures all around the ancient world. The deeper you dig, the more obvious it becomes that they did not get these shared features from one another, but from a remote common ancestor of them all. We see only the effects and modes of expression of that inheritance, not its source, and all searches for the key to the mystery have thus far been in vain. My proposal, simply, is that America offers us that key, and that it does so because of the unique circumstances of its prehistory. Unlike the interconnected land masses of Africa and Eurasia, and unlike Australia, which was relatively accessible by sea from the extreme southeast of Asia, we've seen that the Americas were isolated during much of the Ice Age, a geological epoch that lasted, let us not forget, from around 2.6 million years ago until around 12,000 years ago. In this long geological epoch, however, there were several periods of temporary climate warming when the macrocontinent of North, Central, and South America would have become accessible. Two of these periods of enhanced accessibility occurred within the known time frame of past human migrations, and it is the most recent, the so-called Bolling-Alarod interstadial, dated from around 14,700 years ago to around 12,800 years ago, that archaeologists focused their attention on for far too long in their attempts to reconstruct the true story of the peopling of the Americas. I think paleontologist Tom Demarest is on to something huge with this plea that he makes to the scientific community, discussed in Chapter 5. What we're saying to everyone, really, is open your mind to the possibility that instead of the peopling of the Americas being associated with the last deglaciation event, the Bolling-Alarod interstadial, what we should actually be looking at is the deglaciation event before that, between 140,000 and 120,000 years ago. You get the same sort of scenario with a land bridge and ice sheets retreating, and you get the same sweet spot between really low sea levels and a blockage by ice sheets gone, and the flooding of the land bridge. Demarest's suggestion still remains unpalatable to some archaeologists, yet it satisfactorily explains the growing mass of evidence that the Americas were peopled many tens of millennia before the Bolling-Alarod interstadial. More than that, this hitherto unimagined possibility of a very old rather than very young human presence in the New World helps make sense of the complex genetic heritage of Native Americans. Embedded in this evidence is the mind-dilating mystery of the strong Australasian DNA signal present among certain isolated tribes of the Amazon rainforest. It's a recent discovery and highly significant, because it raises the possibility that transoceanic voyages were being undertaken more than 12,000 years ago, a notion hitherto considered impossible by archaeologists. If the technology and geodetic know-how to make such voyages were indeed present in the world during the Ice Age, then we are, by definition, dealing with a lost civilization. And this, of course, brings us to the mystery of the Amazon itself. Was it in some way touched by a civilization advanced enough to have explored all the world's oceans during the Ice Age? And if so, has any evidence of that influence remained? In chapters 11 through 17, I address these questions and present evidence that human settlement in the Amazon is extremely ancient, that great cities and large populations once flourished there, that ancient scientific knowledge of the properties of plants persists among Amazonian peoples to this day, that there was very early domestication of useful agricultural species, that the rainforest itself is an anthropocentric, cultivated, ordered garden, and that a miraculous man-made soil, terra preta, was developed in the Amazon in deep antiquity, bringing fertility to otherwise agriculturally unproductive lands, and imbued with astonishing powers of self-renewal that modern scientists marvel at and do not yet fully understand. In parallel, and again a recent discovery, is the presence of gigantic geometrical earthworks and astronomically aligned stone circles in the Amazon. I show in chapters 15 and 16 that these remarkable structures share significant scientific memes with the henges and stone circles of the British Isles and with other works of ancient sacred architecture all around the world. I suggest this is not coincidental, nor due to the direct influence of one region upon the other, but that it bears witness instead to a shared legacy, a shared package of sacred geometrical and astronomical blueprints inherited in both these widely separated regions from an earlier civilization lost to history. Chapter 17 returns to the theme of plant gnosis in the Amazon, looks into the mysteries of the vision-inducing brew ayahuasca, and hears the words of ayahuasca shamans, who see geometric patterns as portals to other realms of existence, specifically to the afterlife realm or land of the dead. Indeed, the very name ayahuasca means vine of the dead or vine of souls. In chapters 18 through 21, I explore the deep structural similarities between the Amazonian geoglyphs and the great mounds and geometric earthworks of the Mississippi Valley. It's not simply a matter of appearances. Mississippian religious ideas, like those of the ancient Amazon, were focused on the mystery of death and on certain very specific notions concerning the afterlife journey and destination of the soul. I show that these notions are extremely ancient in North America and trace them back into remote prehistory through a succession of sites such as Poverty Point, Lower Jackson Mound, Watson Break, and Conley, where the same astronomical and geometric memes consistently reappear. Chapter 22 recounts my own close encounter as a teenager with the mystery of death and how my interest in this mystery was reawakened when I first studied the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead many years later. I described the Duat, the afterlife realm as depicted by the ancient Egyptians, and the souls are sent to the constellation Orion, and thence through a portal or doorway in the sky to a journey along the Milky Way. And I describe my astonishment on a visit to Moundville in Alabama to learn that what appeared to be exactly the same system of ideas involving Orion, the Milky Way, and a journey to the realm of the dead was also a predominant motif of the Mississippian civilization. In chapters 23 and 24, I offer a detailed investigation of Mississippian and ancient Egyptian ideas concerning the afterlife journey and destiny of the soul. The parallels, in my view, are too remarkable, too many, and too detailed to be explained by coincidence. Nor do they point to a direct influence of ancient Egypt on the Mississippian civilization or vice versa, chronologically impossible because they existed at completely different times. As with the geoglyphs, what is indicated here is a legacy of ideas inherited in both these widely separated areas from a remote common source as yet unidentified by archaeologists. Could that common source, that lost civilization, have had its Ice Age homeland in North America? I set out to answer that question in chapters 25 through 27, where I present detailed evidence of the immense cataclysm that shook the earth around 12,800 years ago, a cataclysm that was global in its consequences, but that had its epicenter in North America. For more than two decades, while eliciting patronizing sneers and sometimes extreme hostility from the scholarly establishment, I've consistently maintained that my proposed lost civilization was erased from history in a global cataclysm somewhere around 12,500 years ago. At first, the very suggestion that there had been a cataclysm at all and that it might be of immense relevance to the past of our species was singled out for particular ridicule, but then came a mass of new evidence that shifted the balance of the argument decisively. Within the resolution limits of radiocarbon calibration, where at such a remove, margins of error of two or three centuries are the norm, the date for the cataclysm of around 12,500 years ago that I first put into print in 1995 is extremely close to the date of around 12,800 years ago that scientists have much more recently established for the impacts of multiple fragments of the giant disintegrating comet that precipitated the catastrophic onset of the Younger Dryas. It seems, then, that there was a global cataclysm, and at more or less the very time I had proposed. But so what? Just because I got lucky on the timing of the cataclysm doesn't mean I was right that it wiped out an advanced prehistoric civilization. Show us its homeland, the skeptics therefore quite reasonably demanded. This book is, in part, my response to that challenge. More than enough time for a civilization to develop. Hitherto, Ice Age North America has been seen as an uninhabited archaeological vacuum, awaiting the arrival of culture with the first human migrations across the Bering Land Bridge. Because of the entrenched belief that these migrations came relatively late, at a time when our ancestors had been out of Africa and already established in Europe, Asia, and Australia for tens of millennia, there was no reason to seek the origins of civilization in such an unlikely place. In the light of the new evidence on the very ancient peopling of the Americas that we have explored, however, and of the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, I suggest that the balance of the argument has once again shifted decisively. Whereas before, it was reasonable to ask why the homeland of the lost civilization should have been in North America, the more pertinent question today is why should it not have been in North America, the continent that suffered more severe disruption than any other and that had so much of its rich prehistory pounded, pulverized, and swept away by the devastating events of 12,800 years ago. Not for the first time in this investigation, I'm reminded of what Tom Demaray told me when he showed me the finds from the Cerruti Mastodon site at the Nat in San Diego. If you go to a place and you absolutely rule out in advance that humans were there 130,000 years ago, then you're clearly not going to find evidence that they were. But if you go with an open mind and dig deep enough in the right places, then who knows what you might turn up. Tom was talking about the conclusion that he and his team had reached concerning the mastodon remains now on show in his museum, namely, as we heard in Chapter 5, that they had been scavenged by human beings 130,000 years ago. His point was that an ingrained perception that no humans could have reached the Americas by such an early date had for too long inhibited investigation of alternative scenarios, and that perhaps much more evidence of a very early presence would be found if a more targeted and determined search were made. Using rocks intelligently to smash mastodon femurs so that the marrow can be extracted is certainly not the work of a lost civilization of any kind. It is the work of ancestral humans, perhaps anatomically modern, perhaps not. But the real importance of the Cerruti mastodon site is that it provides the first solid evidence, solid enough to make it into the pages of nature, of a truly ancient human occupation of the New World. If humans were in North America 130,000 years ago, more than twice as long as the span of the known human presence in Europe, That gives them 117,000 years to have evolved a high civilization before the Younger Dryas cataclysm struck. And why should they not have done so? What is particularly special or inviolable about the so-called march towards civilization that seems to begin with the onset of the Neolithic at the end of the Younger Dryas? Why did it happen then and not before? Why shouldn't there have been an earlier march towards civilization that began with an earlier peopling of the Americas, not with the last deglaciation event, but, as Tom Demarest suggested, with the deglaciation event before that, between 140,000 and 120,000 years ago? Thereafter, until the next episode of deglaciation, the Bolling-Alerod Interstadial, in the 2,000 years immediately preceding the Younger Dryas, all scholars agree that the vast landmass of the Americas, straddling half the globe, was cut off from the rest of the world by the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and by mountains of ice. Migrants from Asia, even when Beringia was accessible, could not get in. But for those humans who were already south of the ice cap 120,000 years ago, the Americas must have been a paradise, safe from incursions by any other peoples, and blessed with an astonishing abundance and variety of natural resources. The New World offered conditions utterly different from those available on any other continent, so I see no reason why the very first of the first Americans should not also have followed a radically different path from other humans, a path that more rapidly veered away from hunting and gathering, and that led ultimately to the emergence of a precociously early civilization. Mysterious powers. If the Younger Dryas Earth changes wiped a prehistoric civilization from the record, then can anything useful ever be said about the character of that civilization? Thus far, extrapolating from the belief systems of its descendants, I've suggested that its spirituality must have involved profound explorations of the mystery of death. I've suggested that accurate ancient maps depicting the Earth as it looked during the Ice Age imply that it had developed a level of maritime technology at least as advanced as that possessed by European seafarers in the late 18th century. I've suggested that it had mastered sophisticated geometry and astronomy. I've also suggested that such a lost civilization, maturing in isolation for tens of thousands of years in North America, might have taken a very different path from our own and might have developed technologies that archaeologists would be unable to recognize because they operated on principles or manipulated forces unknown to modern science. In his 1920 study, The Interpretation of Radium, Nobel Prize winner Frederick Soddy, one of the pioneers of nuclear physics, speculated as to the former existence of a wholly unknown and unsuspected ancient civilization of which all other relic has disappeared. He drew attention to the seemingly limitless stores of nuclear energy that were in his time understood to be possessed by certain elements such as radium, and compared these to the fabulous Philosopher's Stone, credited in ancient traditions with mysterious powers of transmutation and regeneration. The similarity, he felt, was no coincidence, but an echo from one of many previous epochs in the unrecorded history of the world. "Can we not read into such traditions," he wrote, "justification for the belief that some former forgotten race of men attained not only to the knowledge we have so recently won, but also to the power that is not yet ours? Science has reconstructed the story of the past as one of a continuous ascent of man to the present-day level of his powers. In face of the circumstantial evidence existing of this steady upward progress of the race, the traditional view of the fall of man from a higher former state has come to be more and more difficult to understand. From our new standpoint, the two points of view are by no means so irreconcilable as they appeared. A race which could transmute matter would have little need to earn its bread by the sweat of its brow. If we can judge from what our engineers accomplish with their comparatively restricted supplies of energy, such a race could transform a desert continent, thaw the frozen poles, and make the whole world one smiling Garden of Eden." possibly they could even explore the outer realms of space. The legend of the fall of man may be all that has survived of such a time before, for some unknown reason, the whole world was plunged back again under the undisputed sway of nature to begin once more its upward, toilsome journey through the ages. In the 2020s, as would not have been the case in the 1920s, there's a good chance archaeologists would recognize an ancient technology designed to exploit nuclear power. And if they didn't, they would certainly be able to call in someone who did. This is because our own science has now advanced to a level where nuclear power is familiar to us. By contrast, Soddy's imagining of a lost high civilization of prehistoric antiquity that had fully penetrated the mysteries of the atom was written in the infancy of our risky dance with nukes, 25 years before Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and 35 years before the first nuclear power stations came online. A man of his time, therefore, when the almost magical potential of the new technology was becoming apparent, but when its downsides were largely unknown, Soddy was all idealism. He could not have anticipated that the immense power of the atom, once fully harnessed, would never be used to transform deserts, thaw the poles, or make the whole world one smiling Garden of Eden, but would instead be deployed primarily for destructive purposes in the form of bombs and missiles, or for generating electricity at the long-term cost of poisoning the Earth. It is not necessarily the case that an earlier, advanced civilization would have chosen the nuclear path so enthusiastically envisaged for it by Soddy. Nor must it inevitably have taken the path of leverage and mechanical advantage that historical civilizations have so doggedly trudged down for the past few thousand years on their way to the machine age. I return again to my point. Since we are considering the possibility of a wholly unknown and unsuspected civilization, we must also consider the possibility that it might have developed wholly unknown and unsuspected ways of manipulating matter and energy, which we might therefore be unable to recognize, even if the evidence was right before our eyes. Perhaps this is why modern archaeologists, trained to analyze ancient construction techniques through the reference frame of leverage and mechanical advantage, are unable to provide convincing explanations for a number of significant architectural problems of the ancient world. Take the case of the massive beams, quarried from solid granite and weighing in the range of 70 tons each, incorporated into the core of Egypt's Great Pyramid in the series of relieving chambers stacked on top of the King's Chamber, more than 50 meters, 164 feet, above ground level. None of the wishful scholarly claims of megaliths somehow being slid easily into place on wooden rollers or on lubricated sand will work at this elevation. The fact of the matter is that the hulking beams forming the floors and ceilings of the relieving chambers are where they are, and that in order to get there, they had to be lifted more than 50 meters into the air. Or consider the Trilithon at Baalbek in Lebanon. Here, 20 feet above the ground, three immense ashlars, weighing more than 800 tons each, have been placed end to end within a wall of smaller blocks and so tightly fitted that the joints can barely be seen. It wouldn't be an easy feat, even with 21st century technology. So how could it possibly have been accomplished thousands of years ago? Let us also not forget the marvel of Sacsayhuaman, perched on a ridge above the city of Cusco in the Peruvian Andes at an altitude of 3,700 meters, 12,140 feet. I have made the case in previous books that this supposed Inca site was already enormously ancient at the time of the Incas and has been wrongly attributed to them. Of particular relevance here are its colossal megalithic walls, arranged in a series of zigzags and consisting of intricately formed polygonal blocks. No two blocks among the thousands at Sacsayhuaman are the same shape. Some weigh more than 300 tons, and all are so tightly interlocked in all dimensions that the edge of a piece of paper cannot be slipped between the joints. Efforts by archaeologists to reconstruct how the work at Sacsayhuaman was done have proved as ludicrous as a failed attempt in 1978 to build a midget-sized scale model of the Great Pyramid. And once again, this is because the only reference frame deemed acceptable, involving leverage and mechanical advantage, is unable to account for many of the more complex anomalies. There is an answer, but it involves looking outside the box. At the Great Pyramid, at Baalbek, and at Sacsayhuaman, as well as at numerous other mysterious sites, such as the almost unbelievable Kailasa temple hewn out of solid basalt at Ellora in the Indian state of Maharashtra, intriguing ancient traditions persist. These traditions speak of meditating sages, the use of certain plants, the focused attention of initiates, miraculously speedy workmanship, and special kinds of chanting or tones played on musical instruments in connection with the lifting, placing, softening, and molding of megaliths. My guess, confronted by the global distribution of such narratives and by the stark reality of the sites themselves, is that we're dealing with the reverberations of an ancient technology we don't understand, operating on principles that are utterly unknown to us. Snoddy, imagining a lost civilization that had developed machines powered by nuclear energy, speaks of exploring the outer realms of space and manipulating the global climate, but I beg to differ. I don't think nuclear power was involved, and I don't think machines were involved either. As I near the end of my life's work and of this book, I suppose the time has come to say in print what I've already said many times in public question and answer sessions at my lectures, that in my view, the science of the lost civilization was primarily focused upon what we now call psi capacities, that deployed the enhanced and focused power of human consciousness to channel energies and to manipulate matter. Although psi research is still undertaken at a small number of universities and institutes in Britain, the United States, and Russia, it is generally ridiculed and sidelined by modern mainstream scientists. This categorically does not mean that there's nothing to psi, but instead speaks volumes about the nature of science today, which is heavily dominated by materialist thinkers whose reference frame has little room for spooky action at a distance. The phrase, which was Einstein's, refers specifically to the paradoxes of quantum entanglement, but applies equally well to other alleged non-local phenomena such as 1. Telepathy, communication from one person to another of thoughts, feelings, desires, etc., involving mechanisms that cannot be understood in terms of known scientific laws. 2. Remote viewing, the practice of seeking impressions about a distant or unseen target, purportedly using extrasensory perception. 3. Telekinesis, the movement of a body caused by thought or willpower without the application of physical force. 4. Healing powers, whereby patients are successfully cured of their ailments by non-physical and non-medical means. My speculation, which I will not attempt to prove here or to support with evidence, but merely present for consideration, is that the advanced civilization I see evolving in North America during the Ice Age had transcended leverage and mechanical advantage, and learned to manipulate matter and energy by deploying powers of consciousness that we have not yet begun to tap. In action, such powers would look something like magic even today, and must have seemed supernatural and godlike to the hunter-gatherers who shared the Ice Age world with these mysterious adepts. Keep in mind that we're talking about a Native American civilization growing to maturity at some point during the long interval between the scavenging of the Cerruti Mastodon 130,000 years ago and the cataclysmic onset of the Younger Dryas 12,800 years ago. Though we may never know what set it on its own brilliant idiosyncratic path, there is every reason to suppose that its people would have been closely related genetically, linguistically, and at first culturally to other early Native American populations who remained at the hunter-gatherer stage. It follows, therefore, if this hypothetical civilization had sciences, that they should be rooted and grounded in a recognizably Native American reference frame, and therefore would likely have developed under the guidance of shamans and using the methods of shamanism. Telepathy, telekinesis, remote viewing, and healing powers are, of course, all capacities believed to be within the repertoire of master shamans. Indeed, ayahuasca, which lies at the heart of Amazonian shamanism, first entered mainstream Western consciousness under the name telepathine. In 1952, for example, on a quest in Ecuador for the visionary brew, William Burroughs wrote that he had failed to score for Yahe, Banisteriopsis carpi, telepathine, ayahuasca, all names for the same drug. He was determined to find it, however, because of its tremendous implications and the mystery surrounding it, adding, "I'm the man who can dig it." The reason behind the choice of the name telepathine, which began to be applied to ayahuasca as early as 1905, was that Amazonian tribes making regular use of the brew repeatedly stated that it facilitated telepathic communication. The mechanistic Western mind of the 21st century scoffs at such claims, but leading ayahuasca researcher Benny Shannon, professor of psychology at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, concedes that reports of paranormal experiences with ayahuasca abound. Practically everyone who has had more than a rudimentary exposure to the brew reports having had telepathic experiences. Many such reports also appear in the anthropological literature. Similarly, many of my informants said that without overt verbal articulation, they could pass messages to other people present in the ayahuasca session. Likewise, many indicated that they received such messages from other persons or beings, usually in visions in which drinkers feel that they are receiving messages or instructions from beings and creatures. The communication in question is said to be achieved without words, directly, from thought to thought. In the modern world, we are so fixated on our machines and devices that it's almost impossible to imagine life without them. But if telepathy is real, a debate we won't be able to get into here, and if its use and projection could be refined and made reliable, then who would need cell phones or Facebook or any of the other means of communication that are so ubiquitous today? Once again, we would own our own conversations, rather than having to depend on some intermediary or platform to relay them. Might it not be the case that psi powers have always been part of the human heritage, part of our golden age? Perhaps these powers atrophied after the Younger Dryas cataclysm broke our connection to our roots, and perhaps in the aftermath of the cataclysm, the resourcefulness of our species was refocused on techniques of leverage and mechanical advantage, and a negative feedback loop developed that ushered in the march of the machines and saw psi banished to the margins of human experience. Reverse engineering the system. I'll not speculate further here about the lost technology of a destroyed civilization. There are tantalizing hints and clues, but unfortunately, even the first archaeological steps that might make solid progress possible have never been taken. There's more to work with, however, when we come to religious and spiritual beliefs that, according to the Edfu building texts, it was the duty of the survivors of the lost civilization to preserve and to replicate wherever in the world they could find receptive ground. In the 21st century, Christianity and Islam, upstart religions of the past 2,000 years, exercise effective monopolies over the spiritual lives of more than half the world's population. Their simple formula of one creator God, male of course, and of a heavenly paradise for his faithful, paired with a hellish place of punishment for disbelievers and evildoers, brilliantly removes the need for serious thought. All that's required to join the elect is to tick the right boxes and maintain a state of rigid, abiding, unquestioning belief in the authority of the sacred texts and the utterances of the priests and the mullahs self-appointed to interpret them. Perhaps it's the easiest option, requiring the smallest quantum of uncomfortable reflection. But it's certainly not the only one, and neither is atheism, which also rests on unproven beliefs, in any way its opposite. The full range of human spiritual potential cannot be brutally reduced to believing that a God exists or to believing that a God does not exist. Agnosticism is often proposed as the only alternative, but there are far more subtle and even scientific ways forward, explored confidently by our ancestors many millennia ago, that deserve serious attention. Important elements survive in some of the more esoteric aspects of Hinduism and Tibetan Buddhism, notably in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which bears striking similarities to the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead and descends, I suggest, from the same common source. There is much among the Maya, reported in Fingerprints of the Gods and in Heaven's Mirror, that adds to the picture. Meanwhile, Amazonian shamanism and the strangely interlinked religions of the Nile and Mississippi valleys open further vistas for understanding. In particular, whether we speak of the visionary leap to the Milky Way and to the underworld that lies beyond it made by Tucano shamans under the influence of ayahuasca, or of Mississippian ideas concerning the path of souls, or of the ancient Egyptian afterlife journey through the Duat, I think the only reasonable conclusion to be drawn from the material presented in previous chapters is that we're dealing with a complex and sophisticated system of shared ideas inherited from a remote common ancestor. And just as our DNA can be reverse engineered by geneticists to reveal much about our forebears, so too the shared segments of cultural DNA in the religions of the Mississippi Valley and ancient Egypt give us insights into the character of the vastly more ancient predecessor religion that spawned them. That ancient religion, the religion of the lost civilization, was itself, I would contend, a highly specialized offshoot of Native American shamanism, and its primary focus, as is the focus of all shamanism, was the mystery of death. What happens to us when we die? Our society prefers to ignore and marginalize the problem of death. It is an ever-present reality for all of us, much less when we are young, much more as we grow old. And yet we do all we can to avoid it. We know in an abstract sense that it awaits us, but meanwhile we prefer to dwell as little as possible on its implications and to live our lives as though they will never end. The reference frame, out of which such thinking emerges, cannot be pinned on any of the Abrahamic religions, but belongs to the scientism of the modern age, which holds that we are entirely material creatures, random accidents of chemistry and biology, that there is no transcendent meaning or purpose to our existence, that there is no such thing as the soul, that death is final, and that there is no afterlife. If those are your beliefs, which are only a subset of wider beliefs that strip the universe of spirit and conceive of it as some sort of gigantic, unconscious automaton, then of course it makes sense to abjure all thoughts of death and to postpone death for as long as possible, even though many ancient traditions, despised by the scientific mindset, warn that unwillingness to die produces unfavorable results. As here in America, comments W.Y. Evans-Wentz, the translator of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, every effort is apt to be made by a materialistically inclined medical science to postpone and thereby to interfere with the death process. Very often, the dying is not permitted to die in his or her own home or in a normal, unperturbed mental condition when the hospital has been reached. To die in hospital, probably while under the mind-benumbing influence of some opiate, or else under the stimulation of some drug injected into the body to enable the dying to cling to life as long as possible, cannot but be productive of a very undesirable death, as undesirable as that of a shell-shocked soldier on a battlefield. Even as the normal result of the birth process may be aborted by malpractices, so similarly may the normal result of the death process be aborted. Matters would have been handled very differently, I propose, in an advanced Native American civilization that had not severed its roots with shamanism, as we have done, but had instead evolved forms of science and technology that emerged directly from shamanistic preoccupations and shamanistic experiences. Rather than turning its back on death, I expect that such a civilization would have confronted and investigated every aspect of the mystery, and would certainly have deployed trance techniques with scientific objectivity and discipline to explore and test the reality status of the other worlds and underworlds encountered in vision. It is further evidence of a remote common source behind some widespread religious motifs that one of the most famous myths of the ancient Greeks, the tale of Orpheus and Eurydice, was also present long before European contact in the ancient pre-Columbian cultures of North America. Some details vary, as of course do the names of the central characters and the general setting, but the underlying structure remains the same. 1. A wife or sweetheart, Eurydice, dies prematurely. 2. Her husband or lover, Orpheus, follows her soul to the underworld and persuades its ruler to let her return with him to the land of the living. 3. Eurydice's release is agreed on condition that she walk behind Orpheus as they make the return journey from the underworld, and that under no circumstances should he set eyes on her until they reach the land of the living. 4. At the last moment, overcome with love, Orpheus cannot resist glancing over his shoulder at his wife, and in that instant she is cast back into the underworld, that she can henceforth never leave. So compellingly similar are the Native American and Greek versions that leading scholar of religions, Åke Hultcrantz, dedicated an immense monograph to the mystery, published in Stockholm in 1957, titled The North American Indian Orpheus Tradition. Meanwhile, his contemporary, Canadian ethnographer Charles Marius Barbeau, proposed that the Greek and Native American stories must both be offshoots of some much older core narrative, and concluded the worldwide diffusion from an unknown source of a tale so typically classical as Orpheus and Eurydice must have required millenniums. Of course, I agree that the wide distribution of localized versions of the Orpheus and Eurydice myth suggests the great antiquity of the common source from which they all descend. But what I find equally interesting is that the foundations of the narrative clearly lie in the concepts of the afterlife journey of the soul and the duality of spirit and matter, so central to the religious beliefs of ancient Egypt and the ancient Mississippi Valley. Could it be that what we have in these superficially separate but deeply interconnected systems are the surviving threads from a once immense tapestry of thought about the human condition, our place in the cosmos, and the meaning of life and death? And just as our own sciences today are capable of highly sophisticated interventions and manipulations in the realm of matter, might it not be that the sciences of the lost civilization were capable of equally effective interventions and manipulations in the realm of spirit, and possibly therefore had accumulated veridical information concerning dimensions of reality about which we ourselves are presently entirely ignorant? For those who believe that all notions of spirit are fantasy, that consciousness expires with the physical body, and that any form of life after death is therefore impossible, the notion of investing time, resources, and ingenuity in developing a science of death, perhaps better termed a science of the afterlife, or even a science of immortality, sounds like the worst kind of wishful thinking. The consequence, described so eloquently by W.Y. Evans Wentz, is that from the materialistic perspective, the only valid application of science to the problem of death is in the outfitting of hospitals and the preparation of medicines to ease the passing, and if the deceased is otherwise in good physical condition, to recycle his or her organs. But what if our materialist science, which has a pedigree of only a few hundred years since the dawn of the so-called Age of Reason in the late 17th century, is fundamentally incomplete in its analysis of the nature of reality and of the phenomenon of death? And what if the far older tradition of the afterlife journey of the soul, manifested in ancient Egypt and in the ancient Mississippi Valley and by Amazonian shamans to this day, conceals deep truths? If that were the case, then Western scientific materialism might have led us down a very dark and dangerous path indeed. one with repercussions across eternity. In Tibetan Buddhism, the afterlife realm is known as the Bardo, literally, the between. Just like the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead and the Mississippian oral and iconographic traditions, the purpose of the Tibetan Book of the Dead is to serve as a guidebook and instruction manual for the soul on its post-mortem journey through this strange parallel dimension. The between, explains prominent American Buddhist scholar Robert A.F. Thurman, is a time of crisis after death, when the soul, the very subtle mind-body, is in its most highly fluid state. It is a time of extraordinary danger, but also of extraordinary opportunity. If the good person, Thurman argues, who has a strong momentum of good evolutionary action, is unprepared for the between, he or she can lose an enormous amount of evolutionary progress in the twinkling of an eye by becoming frightened and hiding in darkness. Similarly, a bad person, who has a great weight of negative evolution, if well prepared for the between, can overcome immense aeons of wretched lives by bravely shooting for the light. After all, a tiny achievement on the subtle plane can have a powerful impact on the gross. The soul in the between can directly modify, just with creative imagination, what the Buddhists call the spiritual genes it carries with it. The between voyager has temporarily an immensely heightened intelligence, extraordinary powers of concentration, special abilities of clairvoyance and teleportation, flexibility to become whatever can be imagined, and the openness to be radically transformed by a thought or a vision or an instruction. This is indeed why the between traveler can become instantly liberated just by understanding where he or she is in the between, what the reality is, where the allies are, and where the dangers. Western science possesses unprecedented knowledge of the material realm, over which it has achieved extensive mastery. We should not assume, however, that this means it is also automatically in possession of superior knowledge that refutes the Tibetan science of death, the phrase that Robert Thurman uses to describe the teachings in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. On the contrary, since Western science has shunned the investigation of the afterlife because of the unevidenced preconception that there is no such thing, we should rather accept that Tibetan Buddhism, which has devoted long centuries of intelligent study to the matter, may be far ahead of us. Moreover, as I've argued, the Tibetan Book of the Dead descends from the same vastly older progenitor that also gave rise to the ancient Egyptian and Mississippian systems, and therefore might potentially be harnessed, like them, to the task of reconstructing that progenitor. My sense is that the lost civilization, as might be expected with its proposed shamanic origins, was not much interested in material things. Like many other Native American cultures, its primary goals were not to do with the acquisition of status or wealth, but instead were focused, through vision quests and right living, on the perfection of the soul. From the complexity and deep wisdom that still shines through in its offspring religions, I suggest that it took these inquiries very far into regions of mystery that in our culture, even quantum physicists and scientists engaged with virtual reality have barely begun to contemplate. In order to prepare its initiates thoroughly so that they might be well equipped for the ultimate journey of death, surely a matter of far greater significance than any material concerns, the direct exploration of parallel dimensions would, as noted earlier, almost certainly have been undertaken. Had this investigation been allowed to proceed uninterrupted, it might by now have transcended space, time, and matter entirely. But 12,800 years ago, a deadly mass of matter in the form of the Younger Dryas comet was flung at it and brought a pause to the great prehistoric quest. A pause, but not a halt, for if I'm right, there were survivors who attempted, with varying degrees of success, to re-promulgate the lost teachings, planting sleeper cells far and wide in hunter-gatherer cultures in the form of institutions and memes that could store and transmit knowledge, and when the time was right, activate a program of public works, rapid agricultural development, and enhanced spiritual inquiry. As to the fate of the lost civilization itself, I can only guess that its North American homeland, in which it may have evolved in comparative isolation for more than 100,000 years, was located in one or several of the immense areas south of the ice cap, from the channeled scablands of Washington State in the west, through Nebraska, Wyoming, and the Dakotas, through the Great Lakes, where one of the most devastating impacts may have occurred, and east to the Finger Lakes of upstate New York. I've suggested that this was a seafaring civilization, able to map the Ice Age world and spread its influence to remote shores. But if it had harbors on the Atlantic and Pacific coasts of North America 13,000 years ago, they would have been submerged by the rapid rise in sea levels at the onset of the Younger Dryas 12,800 years ago, and by the even more massive rise that marked the end of the Younger Dryas 11,600 years ago, when the remnant ice caps of North America and Europe simultaneously collapsed into the oceans. Past imperfect, future uncertain. There are literally thousands of myths from every inhabited continent that speak of the existence of an advanced civilization in remote prehistory, of the lost golden age in which it flourished, and of the cataclysm that brought it to an end. A feature shared by many of them, the story of Atlantis, for example, or of Noah's flood, is the notion that human beings, by their own arrogance, cruelty, and disrespect for the earth, had somehow brought the disaster down upon their own heads, and accordingly were obliged by the gods to go back to basics and learn humility again. Where does this sense of ancestral guilt come from, with its peculiar intimations of a mistaken direction taken by humanity in some remote period and purged by a global catastrophe? These are not the kinds of thoughts one would expect hunter-gatherers to devote much time to. A technologically advanced people, on the other hand, particularly if they had mastered the transmutation of matter, would have had vastly more potential for hubris and overreach. In the event of the cataclysmic downfall of their civilization, those who survived might well have reflected on their history and blamed themselves for what happened. Who knows? Perhaps some hubristic excesses had occurred that would have justified such speculations. A drift towards self-indulgent materialism, the introduction of human sacrifice, the appearance of a new and vigorously proselytizing cult denying the existence of the soul, the enslavement and exploitation of hunter-gatherer tribes, the arming of one group of hunter-gatherers, such as Clovis, to give it a competitive advantage over others. There could be a thousand reasons why the humbled survivors of a once powerful but now utterly destroyed civilization seeking refuge among hunter-gatherers might have arrived with a sense of guilt. An Ojibwa tradition seems relevant. It speaks of a comet that burned up the earth in the remote past and that is destined to return. The star with the long, wide tail is going to destroy the world someday when it comes low again. That's the comet called Long-Tailed Heavenly Climbing Star. It came down here once, thousands of years ago, just like the sun. It had radiation and burning heat in its tail. Indian people were here before that happened, living on the earth. But things were wrong with nature on the earth. A lot of people had abandoned the spiritual path. The Holy Spirit warned them a long time before the comet came. Medicine men told everyone to prepare. The comet burnt everything to the ground. There wasn't a thing left. There is a prophecy that the comet will destroy the earth again, but it's a restoration. The greatest blessing this island, Turtle Island, will ever have. People don't listen to their spiritual guidance today. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars when that comet comes down again. Our science and technology in the 21st century are close to the point where, should we choose to do so and be willing to divert the necessary resources from, say, military expenditures, it would be within our capacity to sweep our cosmic environment clean of asteroids and cometary debris and thus spare future generations the existential threat of further impacts. What is not within our scientific and technological competence, however, is to restore the Earth and its environment after a major impact has occurred. Astronomer William Napier, professor of astrobiology at the University of Cardiff and a world expert on comets and asteroids, reminds us that the consequences of a global celestial catastrophe would far outstrip our capacity to respond. A modest impact has the potential to end civilization. A giant one might put our species into an irreversible decline, like other primate species past and present. It took over 3 billion years of evolution to produce the sole terrestrial species capable of understanding the universe. And we do not know whether, if we are removed, intelligence is likely to evolve again. Nor do we know whether there are other intelligent species in our galaxy. In the event that we are alone and are removed by some catastrophe, then our galaxy will return to its former dumb state and may never again leave it. In that sense, the survival of this particular species of ape is a cosmic imperative. We have already received fair warning from the universe in the form of the cataclysmic Earth changes at the onset of the Younger Dryas. No serious researcher disputes that those Earth changes occurred, and since 2007 the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis has established itself as the most widely accepted explanation for everything that happened. But at first, the Earth scientists behind the hypothesis could only say that the evidence pointed to a cosmic impactor of some kind, most likely a swarm of fragments from a disintegrating comet. In 2010, however, in a paper published in the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, William Napier added his weight and specific details to the conclusion that a comet had indeed been involved. A giant comet, perhaps 100 kilometers in diameter according to his calculations, that entered the inner solar system on an Earth-crossing orbit somewhere between 30,000 and 20,000 years ago, and thereafter underwent the series of fragmentations that spawned the Taurid meteor stream. This is a normal process for comets, and it's Professor Napier's case that intersection with the fragmenting debris of this exceptionally large comet around 12,800 years ago provides a satisfactory explanation for the postulated celestial origin of the Younger Dryas cataclysm. It's my case that the hit humanity took then erased a remarkable civilization from the record, and that we have remained mired in amnesia ever since. In the process, what is being neglected, despite the increasingly urgent warnings of a handful of astronomers, is that most of the rubble from the ongoing fragmentation of the original comet remains in orbit in the Taurid meteor stream, including some pieces of enormous size, capable of ending civilization again. Indeed, as we heard in Chapter 25, it's Napier's conclusion that this unique complex of debris represents the greatest collision hazard facing the Earth at the present time. In September 2017, drawing on imagery captured by the European Fireball Network, important new research on the Taurids, published in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, gave strong support to Napier's warning. The title of the paper speaks for itself: Discovery of a New Branch of the Taurid Meteoroid Stream as a Real Source of Potentially Hazardous Bodies. The newly discovered branch is part of the Southern Taurids, encountered by the Earth in late October and the first half of November, and it is just one of many indications that humanity's relationship with the Younger Dryas comet is not over. On the contrary, all the evidence from the close observation and investigation of the Taurids now being undertaken by astronomers is that we may be about to enter, or indeed may already have entered, an episode of enhanced danger. Ahead of us, perhaps still some decades away, lie particularly dense and turbulent filaments of the stream, believed to contain dark fragments of the original comet, in one case with a possible world-killing diameter of 30 kilometers. A Time for Change. This book has its roots in much of my earlier work, particularly on ancient Mexico, the ancient Andean civilizations of South America, and ancient Egypt. However, it was not until early December 2016, during a visit I made to North Dakota and to the protest camp named Osseti Sakowin, situated just beyond the present northern boundary of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, that America before crystallized in my mind as a definite concept, coupled with firm intent. Listeners may recall how, from July 2016 onward, a rainbow coalition of Sioux, other Native American tribes, and non-Native American people gathered at Osseti Sakowin in an attempt to stop the laying of an oil pipeline under Lake Oahe on the Missouri River, half a mile north of Standing Rock, in a location where it not only transgressed traditionally sacred lands, but also threatened the reservation's water supply in the event of a spill. Although extremely active and impassioned in the face of a clampdown by militarized security police, the protests of those who had become known as the Water Protectors failed to achieve their immediate objective, which was to have construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline halted completely. Quite to the contrary, on February 7, 2017, the official easement was granted, work to complete the Dakota Access Pipeline went ahead, and the first oil began to flow on June 1, 2017. There were legal challenges from the Sioux, and further protests and controversy following oil spills. In December 2017, some interim restrictions were imposed on the pipeline operator to prevent further spills. But as I write these words in July 2018, oil is still flowing through the pipeline, and it seems that commercial interests have once again effectively trumped the interests and concerns of Native Americans. Central to the entire protest at Standing Rock was the notion that we live at a time when there is an urgent need to change our ways, to adopt a more humble and no longer rapacious approach to the earth, and to receive a spiritual message passed down from the ancients and held in safekeeping by the first Americans. It's a message that resonates profoundly for me with so much that I've learned while researching this book. This is about everyone, Cody Two Bears of the Standing Rock Sioux told me as he explained the larger purpose of the Osseti Sakowin protests. It's such an important time today. Why people need to know this history. Because for one, the history books would never tell you the correct story, the reason why. I talked to a lot of elders and a lot of spiritual leaders. We had to keep our ceremonies secret. We had to keep our stories a secret for so many years to preserve that, because the government was fearful of what we had and who we are as a people. The laws will tell you that. There's even a current standing law today in Montana. I don't think they've taken it out of their law book, that if you see three Native Americans all together, then you are able to shoot and kill them. Still legal in Montana. Those are the types of laws they created because they don't want to see Native Americans gather, because for some reason they were fearful of us. But little do they know, our ceremonies and our ways of life protected us and Unkimaka, Mother Earth. We prayed even for those people who were afraid of us to help them, to pray for them, to make sure they were okay. That's what our ceremonies are based around. It's not witchcraft. It's not casting spells on anybody. But that's what they thought for many, many years. For example, the ghost dances we used to have in Lakota and Dakota country. When we did that, the Wasichu, white people, literally those who always take the largest portion, were so fearful. They thought we were casting spells, when all in all, we were trying to keep the balance with the earth and the stars. We need to keep that balance, because if we don't start doing that today, we're not going to have anywhere to live in the next 100 years. Some 12,800 years ago, the balance between the earth and the stars was lost, and a key chapter of the human story was lost with it. If it happens again, if our brief chapter too is lost, will all that remains of us at some vast remove in the future be an unhappy myth that tells of how, through our own greed and conceit, through our own recklessness and disregard for the planet in our care, and through our own excessive hate and dearth of love, we conspired in our own downfall. Appendix 1. Melazonia, aka Amanesia. Although they are a world apart and separated by 40,000 years or more of human history, certain striking resemblances and remarkable similarities between societies in Amazonia and Melanesia have kept scholars puzzled for more than a century. One of these puzzles concerns the skull shapes of indigenous Amazonians and Melanesians, and an always unorthodox theory known as the Paleo-American hypothesis that proposes, on the basis of cranial morphology, just a fancy name for skull shapes, that two temporally and source-distinct populations colonized the Americas. The earlier population reportedly originated in Asia in the late Pleistocene and gave rise to both Paleo-Americans and present-day Australo-Melanesians, whose shared cranial morphological attributes are presumed to indicate their common ancestry. The Paleo-Americans were in turn thought to have been largely replaced by ancestors of present-day Amerindians, whose crania resemble modern East Asians, and who are argued to be the descendants of later arriving Mongoloid populations. The presence of Paleo-Americans is inferred primarily from ancient archaeological specimens in North and South America, and a few relict populations of more recent age, which include the extinct Periques and Fuego Patagonians. The Paleo-American hypothesis predicts that these groups should be genetically closer to Australo-Melanesians than other Amerindians. Manasseh Raghavan and S.K. Willislev, both of the Center for Geogenetics at the University of Copenhagen, put the hypothesis to the test at the genetic level as part of their study, discussed in Part 3, and found that the ancient and more recent Native American skulls previously identified as having Australo-Melanesian morphology in fact cluster at the genetic level with other Native American groups and show no affinity to Australo-Melanesians. Their data joined a mass of pre-existing genetic evidence pointing to the same conclusion. For example, another study found that even the most ancient skulls displaying traits attributable to Paleo-American crania turned out, after genetic sequencing, to present the same mtDNA haplogroups as later populations with Amerindian morphology. A third comparative study of morphometric and molecular mtDNA haplogroup data from ancient and more recent Native American skeletal remains likewise concluded that human populations inhabiting the Americas during archaic times cannot be considered as belonging to two different groups on the basis of the analyzed data. In other words, although their skulls might indeed appear different and much more like Australo-Melanesian skulls than more recent Amerindian skulls, Paleo-Americans turn out to be genetically indistinct from more recent Amerindian populations, since genotype trumps phenotype every time as evidence for relatedness. The Paleo-American hypothesis has therefore been regarded for some years as disproved. Following their own study, however, discussed in Chapter 9, Pontus Skoglund and David Reich, both of the Department of Genetics, Harvard Medical School, seem open to reconsidering the whole question when they describe their hypothetical population Y that likely contributed to the DNA of Native Americans from Amazonia and the Central Brazilian Plateau as a lineage more closely related to present-day Australasians than to present-day East Asians and Siberians. They go on to add, this discovery is striking in light of interpretations of the morphology of some early Native American skeletons, which some authors have suggested have affinities to Australasian groups. The largest number of skeletons that have been described as having this craniofacial morphology and that date to younger than 10,000 years old have been found in Brazil, the home of the Surui, Caritiana, and Zavante groups who show the strongest affinity to Australasians in genetic data. What has never been substantially in dispute is that the craniometric similarities between ancient populations from the Brazilian Amazon and Australo-Melanesian populations are real and quantifiable. Moreover, while equally real and quantifiable, the genetic data suggesting that these similarities are not evidence of relatedness, but must be coincidental, or perhaps the result of some sort of bizarre parallel evolutionary process, seems to me, and clearly to Skoglund and Reich as well, to be directly contradicted by that Australo-Melanesian signal sending out its rather compelling message of relatedness from Brazil. In view of this, I'd say at the very least that the earlier craniometric data needs to be revisited, particularly a study by Walter A. Nevis and Mark Hube, published in December 2005 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in which the largest sample of early American skulls ever studied, 81 skulls from Brazil's Lagoa Santa region, is compared with worldwide datasets representing global morphological variation in humans through three different multivariate analyses. In their paper, Nevis and Hube point out, whereas late prehistoric, recent, and present Native Americans tend to exhibit a cranial morphology similar to late and modern Northern Asians, the earliest South Americans tend to be more similar to present Australians, Melanesians, and sub-Saharan Africans. After conducting detailed measurements and analyses of their collection of 81 ancient Brazilian skulls and running their global comparisons, Nevis and Hube are confident that the results obtained from all multivariate analyses confirm a close morphological affinity between South American Paleo-Indians and extant Australo-Melanesian groups. They then go on to offer two different hypotheses to explain the morphological differences observed between early and late native South Americans. One is a local microevolutionary process that transformed in situ the Paleo-American morphology into that prevailing today among Native Americans. The other is that the Americas were successively occupied by two morphologically differentiated human stocks, with the Paleo-American morphology entering first. We believe the second hypothesis is more plausible for three reasons. First, it would be very unlikely that the same evolutionary event happened in the Americas and in East Asia in parallel at approximately the same time. Second, because in South America at least, the transition between the two morphological patterns was, as far as we know, abrupt. And third, cranial morphology has recently been shown to respond adaptively only to extreme environmental conditions, being therefore much less plastic than originally thought. In short, as Nevis and Hube summarize elsewhere in their paper, their results support the hypothesis that two distinct biological populations could have colonized the New World in the Pleistocene-Holocene transition. This, of course, is a conclusion arrived at from the craniometric data, but it is also precisely the conclusion arrived at by Skoglund and Reich from their reading of the genetic data, namely, as the title of their 2015 Nature paper indicates, that there is genetic evidence for two founding populations of the Americas. On the other hand, as we've heard, Raghavan and Willislev disagree. In their science paper, they favor instead a single founding population. Clearly, in a state of affairs like this, where the experts come to radically different conclusions based on nuances within essentially the same data, it would be unwise to go with one side or the other. Whether in the form of skulls or genes, though, it seems to me that the clues so far point in the direction of, to say the least, some sort of forgotten connection. There's more. Two Towers of Babel. Several researchers have noted that Australo-Melanesia and the Americas both manifest extraordinary linguistic diversity, featuring much greater numbers of languages than in all other parts of the world. An implication of this, argues anthropologist German Siebel, is that measured by the number of independent linguistic stocks, linguistic divergence in the Americas must have taken at least 35,000 years. Of course, this figure cannot be taken literally, but there's a marked contrast between language diversity in the Americas and in places like Papua New Guinea, with human archaeological record of some 40,000 years, and language diversity in Africa. Austin Whittall, an author and regular blogger on ancient South American genetics and anthropological issues, also comments on the surprising phenomenon of high levels of linguistic diversity in Australo-Melanesia and the Americas. Why do Native American people speak so many languages? They supposedly reached the New World recently, yet evolved over 40% of the global languages, a figure higher than that found in Africa, the cradle of mankind. Africans have had the time and the advantage of not going through bottlenecks, so they should have evolved more languages than any other group of humans, but they have not. New Guinea, Whittle points out next, has the highest language diversity in the whole world. Indeed, Authority on World Languages, Ethnologue, confirms that there are 841 living languages in Papua New Guinea, which make up 11.85% of living languages in the world. Whittle finds this quite reasonable. The island is a jungle, with many mountain ranges that isolate populations and keep them from mixing. New Guinea has been considered as one of the first places reached by mankind during our epic trek out of Africa. But America is different. The Papuans had 50,000 years to develop their languages. The Amerindians had less than 15,000 years. So how do we explain this? The linguistic diversity of the Americas is an anomaly. Whittle is absolutely right about this, and its parallels with the linguistic diversity of New Guinea and Australasia in general are intriguing. A table reproduced in Whittle's blog makes the anomaly clear. Total numbers of separate language families by macrocontinent, Africa and Eurasia, 87, which is 25% of the total. Australasia, 110, which is 32% of the total. Americas, 144, which is 42% of the total. I do believe, Whittle concludes, that we should look into language diversity as an indicator of an older origin for mankind as a whole and for an earlier date for the peopling of America. It's an excellent point, but for me, the more immediate takeaway is the two clusters of especially abundant linguistic diversity that the table highlights, one in Australasia and the other in the Americas. Moreover, we've already heard that within Australasia, it's Melanesian New Guinea that has by far the highest level of linguistic diversity, indeed higher than anywhere else in the world. Likewise, within the Americas, South America has more than double the linguistic diversity of North America, with the greatest abundance of all found in lowland Amazonia, where no fewer than 350 of South America's total of 448 languages are spoken. Once again, therefore, Melanesian New Guinea and Amazonia seem to parallel one another. Each has the highest level of linguistic diversity within its own macrocontinent, and together they occupy first and second place among the world's most linguistically diverse regions. Now some weird stuff. Melanesia and Amazonia are divided by the full width of the Pacific Ocean, so ethnographers of the late 19th and early 20th centuries were perplexed when they found that certain distinctive customs and patterns of behavior occurred in almost exactly the same forms in both places. For example, the practice of organizing society around so-called men's houses, where the men conducted secret rituals of initiation and procreation, excluded the women, and punished those who would violate the cult with gang rape or death. In both regions, the men told similar myths that explained the origin of the cults and gender separation. The resemblances were such as to convince anthropologists of the day, including Robert Lowy, Heinrich Schurz, and Hutton Webster, that they could only have come about through diffusion. Lowy flatly declared that men's cults are an ethnographic feature originating in a single center and thence transmitted to other regions. The parallels included not only men's cults, but also similar systems of ecological adjustment, egalitarian social organization, flexibility in local and descent group composition and recruitment, endemic warfare, similar religious, mythological, and cosmological systems, and similar beliefs relating to the body, procreation, and the self. The scholarly puzzlement at these sorts of similarities has continued into the 21st century. For example, in a detailed study, Gender in Amazonia and Melanesia, published by the University of California Press in 2001, which followed an international symposium organized by the Wenner Gren Foundation. The symposium was inspired by the suggestion often made by anthropologists that the cultures of Amazonia and Melanesia seem to display startling resemblances, even though they are historically, linguistically, and geographically unrelated. I do not wish to overload the listener with detail from this important in-depth study, but a few examples will give the general flavor of the results. The Munduruku of the Brazilian Amazon and the Avatik of the Sepik River in northern Papua New Guinea both traditionally visited random, indiscriminate violence on outsiders as an internal requirement of the village's male cult. In both cases, raids were seen as a special kind of hunting. In both cases, cult members sought prestige in the eyes of fellow villagers by taking trophy heads during their raids. In both cases, the heads were not brought back to the village until the men had undergone a ritual period of seclusion and sexual abstinence. And in both cases, the heads were believed to enhance and renew fertility. Among the Sambia of eastern Papua New Guinea, as among the Arawete, Jivaro, and Mehenaku of the Amazon, a war leader would traditionally exhibit his erect penis as a sign of his aggression. Among the Alambak, the Sawos, and the Sepik Wape of Papua New Guinea, as among the Kasinahua of the Amazon, domestic conflict prior to a hunt or raid was believed to bring bad luck to the endeavor. In both Melanesia and Amazonia, blood is seen as the main agent of growth and vitality. In both regions, it is blood, especially menstrual blood, that is seen as the mother's contribution to conception or gestation. In both regions, semen is considered closely related to blood or interactive with blood, and many believe more specifically that a fetus is formed by the combination of female blood and male semen. In both Melanesia and Amazonia, the central symbols of the men's cults are bull roarers, flutes, and trumpets, and in both regions, the myths recall a time when women discovered, invented, or possessed these powerful cult objects. In both regions, the myths say that former control of these objects by women allowed them to dominate men. In both regions, the myths also say that men joined forces and compelled or deceived the women into handing the cult objects over to them, resulting in a reordering of society and the dominance of men. Moreover, in both regions, the men share a strategic secret. The sounds of the trumpets, flutes, and other instruments associated with the cult are not the voices of spirits, but are produced by the men themselves. Anthropologist Pascal Bonnemer draws attention to certain striking similarities in initiation rituals, as performed among the Angans of New Guinea and by tribes of the Vaupés region of the Colombian Amazon. These involve the playing of musical instruments that are hidden from women and that were owned by them in mythic times. They imply the consumption of substances that are symbolically associated with reproduction. They are interpreted in a similar way as a rebirth of the young boys into the world of men, and myths offer keys for understanding the ritual. In both Amazonia and Melanesia, there are dire consequences for women, including subjection to gang rape and murder, if they see cult instruments. There is also disruption to society as a whole. Among the Gimi of Papua New Guinea, for example, as among the Barasana of the Amazon, there is a belief that chaos and social disintegration will follow if the men's sacred bamboo flutes are seen by women. Nonetheless, in both Amazonia and Melanesia, the men do not hesitate to parade and play the instruments in public areas such as gardens and plazas that are normally open to women. As such, the men must be extraordinarily vigilant in sequestering the women during rituals, which in practice, in both regions, means forcing them to remain indoors. In summary, as Thomas A. Gregor and Donald Tuzin, editors of Gender in Amazonia and Melanesia, conclude, the similarities of men's institutions in Amazonia and Melanesia is one of the great riddles of culture that has not received the attention it deserves. In their view, It is quite noteworthy enough that the men's house complex obtains in both regions, but what is even more striking is that the details of the cult also bear close comparison. They're right about the magnitude of the riddle, but in my view, the solution they offer is singularly disappointing. Just like the quacks who each year conjure a new mental illness from thin air to add to the already morbidly obese diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders, so too, Gregor and Tuzin are convinced that the whole weird complex of behavior around men's cults in Melanesia and Amazonia is best understood using the tools of psychoanalysis. We need the insights of psychology, and especially that of personality dynamics, to explain the emotional content and the remarkable regularities in men's conduct in such different cultures. Though writing in 2001, they particularly recommend the approach taken in a 1959 paper by Robert Murphy on the Munduruku men's cult. Murphy pointed out that the psychological roots of the cult draw on the universal emotional conflicts associated with the Oedipus complex, the simultaneous fear of women and antagonism towards them, and the associated myths of matriarchy are reflections of the dark side of the family romance. Since the Oedipus complex is universal, Murphy wondered, why are we not all swinging bull roarers? His answer is that men's cults appear to flourish in social environments where the unity of groups of men and groups of women is not blurred by competing modes of role allocation such as derived from political hierarchy or kinship. The small horticultural societies of Amazonia and Melanesia fit this description. Do you hear what's being sold to us here? Wrapped up in the same package of ideas that portrays the cults as the outcome of deep-rooted psychological complexes, we are also being asked to accept that these complexes manifest in the same distinctive ways in Melanesia and Amazonia because of the state of economic development of these societies. Both propositions are profoundly reductionist. The first seeks to reduce the remarkably similar details of male behavior in both regions to underlying psychiatric issues. The second seeks to reduce the cultural expression of such issues to the specific socioeconomic circumstances of small horticultural societies, as though flutes, trumpets, bull roarers, initiation ceremonies, ritual prohibitions, and gang rape and murder for those who break them can be expected to appear, almost automatically, in such societies. There are other options, and the most obvious that immediately springs to mind is diffusion. Throughout human history, ideas, religions, cults, and rituals have always traveled far. Why, therefore, should they not have done so in prehistory as well? As we've heard, Gregor and Tuzin do admit that at one time leading anthropologists were convinced that diffusion of ideas from a single center was the best explanation for the strange cultural similarities between Melanesia and Amazonia, other than adding that subsequently the diffusionist school of anthropology waned, however, Gregor and Tuzin barely give the notion a second thought. Their whole focus remains throughout on psychological and sociological explanations. Who knows? They could be right. They have certainly done a wonderful job of assembling the comparative cultural data. And if I were assessing that data in isolation, if it were just the bizarre and idiosyncratic similarities that keep on cropping up, if that were all there were to it, then I might be impressed by their proposed sociological psychodrama. But that's by no means all there is to it. First and foremost, there's that totally unexpected Australo-Melanesian genetic signal among Amazonian peoples discovered in 2015, which Gregor and Tuzin could not have been aware of in 2001. The very fact that it's there at all means that diffusion of some kind can no longer be ruled out. Second, there's more than a hint of a connection from cranial morphology. Third, Australo-Melanesia and Amazonia constitute the world's largest surviving reservoirs of linguistic diversity, suggesting that their languages have extremely ancient roots. And now fourth, we find complex and multi-layered similarities in cultural institutions and beliefs in both these widely separated regions. It stretches credulity to put the simultaneous occurrence of all these factors down to coincidence. A more parsimonious explanation, I believe, is that something else must have been going on. Some other process must have been underway behind the scenes. Some other hand must have been at work that hasn't yet been accounted for. Appendix 2. Ancient Maps of the Ice Age. The Waldseemüller world map of 1507 is notable for the apparent extreme inaccuracy with which 16th century Southeast Asia and Australia are represented. By contrast, the map offers a much closer map to the region as it appeared in the depths of the Ice Age around 21,300 years ago, when Sahul and Sunda, modern Southeast Asia and Australia, formed an almost continuous landmass. Waldseemüller's and other similar maps of the 16th century were produced by copying from older source maps while attempting to incorporate into them information from the voyages of discovery of Columbus and other later mariners. Deriving from the discarded and lost older source maps, the portrayal of geographical features last present during the Ice Age hints at the existence of a lost civilization that was capable of exploring and mapping the Earth in remotest prehistory. Antediluvian cartography. It is the, at first surprising, hypothesis of Professor Robert Fusson of the University of South Florida that the island named Satanase on the 1424 Pisagano chart, though incorrectly located in the Atlantic Ocean, is arguably the earliest surviving representation of Japan in European cartography. Professor Fusson's 1995 book, Legendary Islands of the Ocean Sea, in which he makes this case with a mass of corroborative evidence, came to my attention while I was researching my own book, Underworld, published in 2002. I'm convinced by Professor Fusson's argument, but what I suggest is equally significant about it is a matter that Fusson himself does not comment on, leaving open the possibility for me to explore it at some length in Underworld, namely that Satanase, Japan, is not depicted as the principal Japanese islands would have looked in 1424 when details from older source maps were copied onto the Pisagano chart, but rather as Japan would have appeared during the lowered sea levels of the last ice age in a very specific interlude between 13,500 and 12,400 years ago, spanning the cataclysmic onset of the Younger Dryas. During that interlude, the three principal Japanese islands, Honshu, Kyushu, and Shikoku, were all conjoined to form a single large island. The depiction of Satanase on the Pisagano chart also shows Honshu, Kyushu, and Shikoku as one island and accurately depicts the inlets that existed between 13,500 and 12,400 years ago, southwest and northeast of what would later become the island of Shikoku. A similar state of affairs presents itself on the other side of the world, in a representation of Ireland and its surrounding waters, in the Ptolemaeus Argentinae map of 1513. It's instructive to compare it with a bathymetric map of Ireland and the surrounding seas. The bathymetry reveals that around 13,000 years ago, during the lowered sea levels of the Ice Age, a significant island with an area of perhaps 100 square kilometers occupied the exact location where the supposedly legendary island named Brazil appears on the Ptolemaeus Argentinae map of 1513. The implication, again, is that some unknown civilization explored the Earth during the Ice Age, and that copies of scraps of the maps made by its seafarers and navigators survived to be used as sources of reference by cartographers in the late Middle Ages. A clear line of transmission through the Library of Alexandria via Constantinople and thence into Europe during the Crusades is traced in Fingerprints of the Gods, for those who wish to follow the matter further. The hole at the bottom of the world. Antarctica remained undiscovered by the seafarers and navigators of our civilization until the year 1819, and accordingly does not feature on early 19th century maps, such as the Pinkerton map of 1818. Curiously, although supposedly undiscovered at that time, Antarctica does appear on several maps from the 16th century, such as the Orontius Finnius world map and the Mercator world map, which in turn were copied from older source maps now lost. Island of Megaliths. The Piri Reis map of 1513 features the western shores of Africa and the eastern shores of North and South America, and is also controversially claimed to depict Ice Age Antarctica as an extension of the southern tip of South America. I report this claim in Fingerprints of the Gods. The same map depicts a large island lying east of the southeast coast of what is now the United States. Also clearly depicted, running along the spine of this island, is a road of huge megaliths. In this exact spot, during the lowered sea levels of the Ice Age, a large island was indeed located until approximately 12,400 years ago. A remnant survives today in the form of the islands of Andros and Bimini. Underwater off Bimini, I have scuba dived on a road of great megaliths exactly like those depicted above water on the Piri Reis map. Again, the implication, regardless of the separate controversy of whether the so-called Bimini Road is man-made or a natural feature, is that the region must have been explored and mapped before the great floods at the end of the Ice Age caused the sea level to rise and submerged the megaliths. Appendix 3. First there was a forest, then there was no forest, then there was. What sort of place was the Amazon during the Ice Age? What was its climate? And what about the environment, vegetation, and trees? Given the enormous importance of the world's largest surviving rainforest in global ecology today, I had assumed the subject would have been well studied and that the experts would long ago have reached a consensus. In the case of the former, I was correct. But in the case of the latter, I was not, for there is an ever-shifting consensus that, when you get right down to it, is pretty much the same thing as no consensus at all. Here's a brief timeline of the debate, as I see it. 1. Prior to and into the 1990s, the scientific consensus supported the view that the Amazon had been largely arid during the Ice Age, with isolated rainforest refugia broken up by extensive areas of savanna and open vegetation. 2. From the mid-1990s onward, into the early years of the 21st century, this entire view came under attack, and out of the dispute, a new consensus emerged in which the Amazon had always, anyway for millions of years, been a rainforest, much as it is now. 3. Finally, in the past decade or so, the consensus appears to have shifted again, and we are told that actually yes, much of the Amazon was savanna during the Ice Age, and that the tropical rainforest we see today has been present for at most 7,000 or 8,000 years, and barely 2,000 years in some areas. It's instructive to spend a few moments sampling the flavor and character of this shifting consensus. Let's start with a paper by P. A. Collinvoe, P. E. de Oliveira, and M. B. Bush, published in January 2000 in Quaternary Science Reviews, that confirms the overthrow of the earlier pre-1990s paradigm of an arid savanna interspersed with rainforest refugia. Our conclusion that the Amazon lowlands were forested in glacial times specifically refutes the hypothesis of Amazonian glacial aridity. A few months later, Catherine Willis and Robert Whittaker of Oxford University published similar conclusions in Science. The evidence clearly indicates that the lowland tropical forests were not extensively replaced by savanna vegetation during the glacial periods, but rather that the forests dominated throughout. In the following year, 2001, a study published in Paleogeography, Paleoclimatology, Paleoecology concluded, in the later Pleistocene, the whole of the Amazon lowlands were under closed canopy forest throughout all stages of a glacial cycle, contrary to the biogeographical consensus of the last 30 years. A 2003 study published in the journal Geology reinforced this view. The current tropical rainforest vegetation has been a permanent and dominant feature of the Amazon River watershed over the past 70,000 years. Specifically, we found no evidence for the development of large savannas that had been previously postulated as indicators of increased glacial aridity in Amazonia. A further study, published in November 2004 in Paleogeography, Paleoclimatology, Paleoecology, investigated the Hill of Six Lakes in the northwest Brazilian Amazon and concluded, "The data indicate the continuous presence of mesic forest throughout the last ice age. Even during low-stand episodes, pollen is well-preserved and provides a clear signal of uninterrupted forest cover." But now, let's jump forward to 2013, when a follow-up study of the Hill of Six Lakes, published in Quaternary Sciences Reviews, lamented the great length of time that Six Lakes was erroneously used as an emblematic locality to illustrate the permanence of the rainforest in the Amazon Basin, because all of the proxies seem to indicate that the present-day vegetation dates back to the middle-late Holocene, around 6,000 calendar years before the present. And a year later, in July 2014, a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences reduced the inception of the present-day forest cover of some parts of the Amazon to just 2,000 years ago or less. Focusing on southern Amazonia, the study concluded that the inhabitants exploited a naturally open savanna landscape that they maintained around their settlement, despite the climatically driven rainforest expansion that began around 2,000 years ago across the region. Last, in Quaternary Science Reviews of October 1, 2017, Professor Diana Fontes and Professor Renato Cordiero published a study titled Paleo-Environmental Dynamics in South Amazonia, Brazil, during the last 35,000 years, inferred from pollen and geochemical records of Lago do Saque. Their conclusion, although they state that the rainforest always existed in this region, is that it underwent expansion and regression over time. There are many other papers I could cite, reflecting the shifting consensus, but I'm sure the listener has got my point by now. When leading scientific authorities are in such a state of disagreement that prevailing paradigms abruptly change every decade or two, we cannot be at all sure of the solidity and merits of the current paradigm, according to which the Amazon rainforest in its present form is less than 8,000 years old, and in some areas less than 2,000 years old. Reviewing the literature, I felt that the conclusion of Fontes and Cordiero that there was always rainforest in the area they studied, but that it was subject to periodic expansions and contractions, might help to explain why consensus on this subject has been so elusive. The Amazon Basin is, after all, a vast and diverse region encompassing more than 7 million square kilometers, of which approximately 5.5 million square kilometers are presently covered by rainforest. The figures only become meaningful by comparison. The whole of India, with a total of 2.97 million square kilometers, is less than half the size of the Amazon Basin, but Australia, at 7.68 million square kilometers, is bigger, as are China, 9.38 million square kilometers, Canada, 9.09 million square kilometers, the United States, 9.15 million square kilometers, and Europe, 10.18 million square kilometers. All in all, then, it's fair to say that what the Amazon confronts us with is a truly gigantic landmass on a scale similar to many of the world's largest countries and regions, extending for thousands of kilometers from north to south and thousands of kilometers from east to west. It's unrealistic to suppose that across such enormous distances over great expanses of time, the climate and environment in all areas would always remain the same. Of course, there would be significant variations among the different regions and from epoch to epoch, and thus a danger of over-enthusiastic extrapolation from particular instances to general conclusions. On March 12, 2018, therefore, I contacted Renato Cordiero about the whole issue of the shifting consensus and what conclusions I might legitimately draw from it. I must confess, I told him, that expert opinion on the Ice Age Amazon is very confusing and contradictory. I want to try and sort out the facts for my readers, as those facts are understood now, if they are indeed subject to any kind of consensus today. Professor Cordeiro teaches geoeconomics at Brazil's Universidade Federal Fluminense. His rather technical reply essentially restated the conclusions of his 2017 paper, that the Amazon basin has always contained rainforests, that the galleria forests along the rivers remained relatively well preserved, even in drier periods, but that in other areas, tree cover has undergone considerable fluctuation over time. It was as close as I was able to get to some kind of answer to what I had thought would be a simple question, namely what sort of climate, environment, vegetation, and trees characterized the Amazon during the Ice Age. The scholars did not agree among themselves, and many different pictures had been painted. But perhaps this was largely because of the immensity of the region and the complex, constantly changing, and often contradictory nature of the data. Indeed, there is only one thing I've been able to find that all the involved scientists appear to be in complete agreement on, and this is that the region was significantly cooler during the Ice Age, 5 or 6 degrees centigrade cooler than it is now. The year-round average temperature of the Amazon rainforest today is 80 degrees Fahrenheit, 26.6 degrees centigrade. So, if anything, a reduction of 5 degrees to 21.6 degrees centigrade, 75 degrees Fahrenheit, would have been a bonus for prospective settlers. So, forests? Savanna? A mixture of both? Like so much else about the ancient Amazon, it seems there is no certain answer.